På grund av ett tekniskt missöde fattas de första 10 minuterna av den här föreläsningen.
People did despicable things in Jesus' name. Now it would be easy to blame the Roman Catholics. The Crusades. That was Roman Catholics. That's not us Protestants. Lutherans. See, after 1517, it was awesome. But of course, I'm sure many of you have read Martin Luther's little booklet, The Jews and Their Lies, and even our theological heroes have said awful things. John Calvin, the Reformation hero, the Reformed tradition hero, was approving of the execution of Michael Servetus, whose only crime was teaching heresy about the Trinity. I expect that very few of us, if anyone in the building, could agree that someone should be killed for teaching false things about the Trinity. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I think we must know, it isn't just the Roman Catholic Church. The Protestant Church has done and said things that we should be ashamed of. Some social studies have begun to explore the negative effects of religion. Martin Seligman is one of the leaders in positive psychology today. And in this book, he reviews all of the psychological and social research about the factors that lead to virtue and vice. It's a secular book, and there's a section on religion, part of which says this. Alport and Ross identified a link between religious orientation and prejudice. Those who scored higher on extrinsic religiousness tended to be particularly prejudiced. The research suggests that people who are externally religious tend to be the most prejudiced people. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't that disturbing? A worldwide poll from Ipsos poll was conducted in 2017. 20 countries were asked the question, do you agree religion does more harm in the world than good? In Australia, 63% of people agreed religion does more harm than good. I'm sorry they didn't include Finland. I have no idea what the Finnish score would be. But Australia was equal second with Germany and Spain at 63% agreeing religion does more harm than good. Only Belgium had a worse view of religion. I don't know, can someone explain to me what's going on in the heads of the Belgians? But I guess Sweden might be close to the Finnish perspective. Is that a wild speculation, or would you say that might be close? So Sweden had a pretty low view of religion as well. My point is, this is a real problem for many, many people. And my first point I want to make today is that real Christians ought to find it easy to admit our fault, to admit that we haven't lived up to our master's ethics. Because to remind you of what I said yesterday, Christians don't believe they are good and only getting better. That's a secular myth. That's not what Christianity teaches. Christianity teaches we are fallen, just like the world. We are fallen. And so We ought to be able to admit our poverty of spirit before God. The opening lines of the Sermon on the Mount are, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." I think poor in spirit means recognizing you are out of credit with God. You have no credit before God. You are bankrupt before God spiritually. That's the first line of the Sermon on the Mount. Later in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus makes this famous statement. "How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there is a plank in your eye?" It's a very famous saying, but Jesus is at least saying Christians should be more aware of their own sin than the sin of the world. That's what speck, plank means. I've often thought about this passage because Jesus grew up as a carpenter, didn't he? He must have many times got a speck of sawdust in his eye. And you know, if you get a speck in your eye, it feels like a plank, doesn't it? It might be tiny, but it feels like, you know, might as well have stuck a tree in your eye. It's like, oh. And maybe that's where Jesus got this, I think, really interesting picture. See, the speck in your eye looks pretty small to me, but if I've got a speck in my eye, it feels like a plank. I think that's what's going on here. And so what I'm saying is, Christians ought to be able to admit we are fallen. We are not good. We should be able to admit the great fault of the church in history and today. And so when our friends, skeptical friends, say to us, "Religion harms the world," instead of rushing to defend everything, first remind yourself that we have a plank. And admit it. That's my first point. And I may have depressed you all. But I have a second point, and a third. My second point is, often the criticisms of Christianity go too far. Often the criticisms of Christianity involve gross exaggerations. They are often partly right, but they often go way, way too far. As if Christianity is the principal cause of war through history. But anyone who knows history knows that that's ridiculous. The Greeks and Romans were doing fine on the war front before the church came along. The Greeks and Romans didn't need Christianity to learn how to kill people and hate them. So we can't say Christianity is a special contributor. And people often make out that it is a special contributor. And I think one of the reasons for this is people try and describe the past era in highly negative terms in order to make our era seem better. We exaggerate the evils of the past to magnify the goodness of the present. Perhaps the classic example of this is the way many people refer to the Middle Ages, when Christianity was very prominent, as the Dark Ages. I'm not sure if that's an expression that is used amongst the Swedish-speaking. It is. But you can see that language itself is propaganda. Dark Ages. Light. Bad. Good. Ignorant. Wise. Yeah? Dark Ages. There's some research that has discovered that the very term, the Dark Ages, was popularized in the 18th century amongst critics of the church. trying to exaggerate the evils of the past to make the Enlightenment period feel better about itself. And in a similar way, people exaggerate the evils of the church, including the Catholic Inquisitions, for example. The Spanish Inquisition was a horrible 350-year period where the church persecuted heretics and interviewed heretics and tortured heretics and killed heretics for 350 years. But I often hear that the Inquisition killed hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. That's what I often hear amongst secular friends. But the best research, not Christian research, the best academic research concludes that the Inquisition killed between 5,000 and 6,000 people over a 350-year period. That's 18 a year. Now, that is 18 a year too many. That's 5,000 or 6,000 people too many. But my point is, how did the Spanish Inquisition come to be a symbol of all that is evil about Christianity when actually it killed very few people compared to secular executions through that same 350-year period? People exaggerate the evil in order to make Christianity look bad and the present look good. Another example is the Troubles of Northern Ireland, which is an interesting modern example of Catholics fighting Protestants. And we can discuss and debate whether their 30 years of conflict was really a religious conflict. It's probably far better explained as simply the British imposing themselves in Northern Ireland and the indigenous Catholics not liking that. But even if it was a religious conflict, how many people were killed in the 30 years conflict between Catholicism and Protestantism? 3,500 over 30 years. But the interesting thing is, people where I come from, probably not here, because I guess Northern Ireland just doesn't seem like an important event, but where I come from, where there are many, many Irish people, the Northern Ireland conflict is often put forward as everything that's wrong with Christianity. You're always fighting each other. You're always killing each other. And it's worth pointing out that 3,500 people over 30 years would hardly rate a mention as a minor skirmish compared to the conflicts going on without any connection with religion. Especially when you compare to a secular conflict like the French Revolution. The French Revolution slaughtered untold thousands of people. In fact, just in the nine-month period known as the Terror, 1793 to 94, they killed 17,000 people in the name of secular liberty. Secular liberty. But people don't wander around the streets saying, oh, secular liberty does more harm than good. People don't wander around going, oh, the French, you know, the cause of all the wars. Although, you know, maybe some people do. Now, think about this. The secular conflict of the French Revolution killed more people in 9 months than the entire 350-year Spanish Inquisition and the entire Northern Ireland conflict combined in just 9 months. And that's before we even begin to talk about the untold millions killed under atheist regimes of the 20th century. Those numbers are astronomical. And my point isn't that secular movements are worse than religious movements. That isn't my point. I am not saying atheists killed more people than Christians, so Christians win. Yay for Christians. We killed fewer people. That's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that the problem isn't religion or irreligion. The problem is the human heart. The fact that secular conflicts can be just as violent as anything religious tells us that the problem is the human heart in possession of a passion unrestrained. It might be a passion for honor, a passion for land, passion for money, passion for revenge, or a passion for religion. The human heart is the problem. The fallenness is the problem. And here is the third thing I want to say. Everyone can tell that what Christ tried to do was shape the human heart by love and mercy. Everyone can tell what Jesus insisted upon. In fact, this problem of the evils of the church is partly such a problem because everyone knows what Jesus said the church ought to be. Everyone knows Jesus asked for love and mercy and turning the other cheek and all of that. Our secular friends know this. And then they look at the church and they see a lack of love and they complain, as they should. Jesus makes us look bad. Everyone knows Jesus said beautiful things like this: love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other also. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. For Jesus, love, even of the enemy, is the core ethic. Because God's love, even of the enemy, is the core of the gospel. Again, I hardly need to say this out loud to Lutherans. The center of the center is Christ's sacrificial death for our forgiveness of sins. And so the central ethic of the Christian faith flows out of the gospel. Because God is so merciful to us, we are to show mercy to others. My point, therefore, is the problem with hateful Christians is not Christianity. It's the fact that they have departed from the way of Christ. I shot some scenes about this in the documentary.
Perhaps no figure in history was more scathing of religious hypocrisy than Jesus of Nazareth. And central to his critique was religion's complicity in the violence that was everywhere in Roman times.
Galilee saw its fair share of religiously motivated violence, and some of it was staged from these caves behind me where rebels could hide from the authorities. Ever since the Romans began to occupy these traditional lands of Israel, some believed that armed resistance was the only practical way to replace a corrupt empire with the kingdom of God.
In 4 BC, the residents of Sepphoris, the capital of Galilee, raided the armory and claimed the town back from the Roman overlords. Rome crushed the rebellion with brutal efficiency. 10 years later, Judas the Galilean ran a guerrilla campaign to expel the pagan occupiers. He was killed, but his sons and grandsons kept the hope alive that one day a great military victory would establish heaven on earth, the so-called kingdom of God.
Jesus taught about the kingdom of God, but he said, if you want to belong to it, you have to shun violence. Love your enemies, he said. Do good to those who hate you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn the other cheek also. To some around here, these words must have sounded bizarre, or at least impractical.
When Jesus said, love your enemies, I think people paused. They may have said, wait a minute, can I hear that again? That sounds so odd. Because you see, people relied on each other in the ancient world. They relied on their neighbors, and there was limited resources. So you didn't just throw your extra around. You were very careful with who you helped, knowing that they would help you in return. That means for someone to say, love your enemies, that just sounded foolish.
Impractical or not, the first Christians, for the first few centuries, took their master seriously. Loving enemies and turning the other cheek were the true ways of God's kingdom, whatever the cost. Within a generation, Christianity spread to Rome. And in the year 64, the first state-sponsored persecution of the church tested the resolve of Christ's followers to maintain their ethic of love. The Roman writer Tacitus records the brutality of Emperor Nero.
Nero punished the Christians with the utmost refinements of cruelty. Vast numbers were convicted. They were covered with the skins of wild beasts and torn to death by wild dogs, or they were fastened to crosses, and when daylight failed, they were burned to serve as lamps by night. Nero had offered his gardens for the spectacle and gave an exhibition in his circus.
It's hard to imagine now, but this is where it happened. Nero's great circus or arena ran straight down here with a massive stadium over there. The crowds watched on as countless numbers of Christians turned the other cheek and loved their enemies all the way to their deaths.
One leader, himself soon to be martyred in Rome, wrote to the church.
In response to their anger, be gentle. In response to their boasts, be humble. And in response to their cruelty, be civilized. Do not be eager to imitate them. Let us show by our gracious forbearance that we are their brothers and sisters. Let us be eager to be imitators of the Lord.
I've known and taught about this event for years, but to actually stand here is quite confronting. I wonder, could I have done what those Christians did?
The first Christians for the first few centuries did indeed follow their master in loving enemies. So at best, the criticisms of Christopher Hitchens and Regina Schwartz and others only prove that Christians haven't been Christian enough, which is something Christians confess every day of their lives, I think. The problem with a hateful Christian cannot be their Christianity, but their lack of Christianity. So in a weird way, the solution to violent, hateful, bigoted Christianity is more Christianity. Even Albert Einstein was not a Christian, was a kind of secular Jew, was asked his opinion of the war and wrote a 3-page essay in 1915. And it was written to German nationalists, but look what he said as a conclusion. "But why so many words when I can say it in one sentence? And in a sentence very appropriate for a Jew. Honor your master, Jesus Christ, not only in words and songs, but rather foremost in your deeds." Einstein knew that the solution to nationalistic, violent, powerful Christianity was a return to real Christianity, to Jesus. So the real question isn't, have Christians participated in the evils common to humanity? The answer to that question is yes, because we are humans and we fail. That's not the real question. The more interesting and revealing question is, what is Christianity's uncommon contribution to humanity? No one can deny Christians have done the same things everyone has done, but what are the unique things Christianity gave the world? Surely that is the real question. And the answer to that question brings us right back to love. Christianity gave the Western world its love of love. I don't say this as a theological statement, simply as a historical statement. Greece and Rome did not teach that you were to love everyone. Never taught love of enemy. Never taught the equality of every human being. Never taught that every human being is precious. Jews, of course, had already taught love of neighbor. The Messiah came and intensified that ethic and said, love not just neighbor, but enemy, fellow sinners. You don't have to just take my word for it. I want to come back to Teresa Morgan, whom we interviewed for the documentary. And she is a world authority on Greek and Roman ethics. She wrote the still sort of standard historical text on what Greeks and Romans in the ancient world thought was the good life, the moral life. It's a marvelous book. And in the documentary, we asked her if she would sum up in one thought what she reckons, as a Roman historian, Christianity brought into the Western world. This is what she said.
I think that insistence by Christianity that God is always loving and always trustworthy and always just, and because of that, Christians are called always to practice those same goods towards God and always to practice those same goods to one another. That is a very big change in thinking from the ethics of the Greek and Roman world, where the gods may be just but may not, where the gods may love human beings but may not, where being merciful, you know, might be the right thing on a certain day but might not, where loving your neighbour, you know, might serve you but might not. The Christian insistence that if those things are good, they are good for everybody and they are always good. I think that was transformational for the Roman world and then for the Christian world, and is perhaps the single greatest contribution of Christianity to public life.
The single greatest contribution of Christianity is the idea that God is consistently love, and therefore his people should be consistently loving. The evidence for this is overwhelming from the ancient world. The very first international aid project we find in the New Testament, actually. Paul conducted a 10-year collection for the poverty-stricken people of Judea. By the year 250, the church was supporting on a daily food roster 1,500 people a day. This is a period where Christians themselves are still being persecuted, and yet they are still caring for 1,500 Romans every day. We have extraordinary evidence from St. Augustine. In the late 4th and beginning of the 5th century, it was common practice for Christians to rescue slaves from the slave ships. We often only associate Christians ending the slave trade with William Wilberforce, right? Who ended it in the British realm. But actually, this letter from Augustine to his colleague Alypius makes very clear Christians are literally rescuing hundreds of slaves out of the slave ships of Hippo in North Africa. They feed them, they clothe them, and they send them back to their families. And Augustine says, we're basically bankrupting ourselves doing this. Amazing. The first free burials in history were offered by the church to the general public. If you've been to the Roman catacombs, this is where Christians in the hundreds of thousands would bury people. And it was a great kindness to the population to offer a free burial. The first recorded public hospital in all of history was started by a Christian woman. Fabiola was the richest woman in Rome in the middle of the 4th century. She came from one of the 7 founding families of Rome. She was a very big deal. She became a Christian. And she used her vast wealth to care for the poor of Rome and to establish a hospital free for everyone. There were hospitals for Roman soldiers on the battlefields, but the average Roman could never walk into a hospital. Fabiola established the principle of free healthcare. Now, I know Scandinavia is very proud of its healthcare system, as well you should be. But you got it from Fabiola. Pagan Emperor Julian was so worried that the Christians were going to convert the whole Roman world, he wrote to pagan priests throughout what we call Turkey, insisting that the Christians, you should look out for the Christians. Watch out. Look what he says. Why do we not observe that it is the Christians' benevolence to strangers and their care for the graves of the dead that have done most to increase this atheism? It may sound puzzling that he calls Christianity atheism, but of course Christians denied all the Greek and Roman gods, so he calls them atheists. But then he says, it is disgraceful that the impious Galileans, the Christians, support not only their own poor, but ours as well. All men see that our people lack aid from us. Here is a pagan enemy of the church in the 4th century saying, watch out for the Christians. They're loving everyone. It's disgusting. We have several of Emperor Julian's letters, and they are funny. They are actually comical to read now, because here is a man panicking that the world's going to become Christian because of the good deeds of the church. My point is, after the New Testament, the Christians followed their master's teaching. followed the gospel by lives of mercy and love. And a large amount of data suggests that the same is true today. I quoted Martin Seligman's book at the outset of this lecture. I explained that this book is an analysis of all the social studies that have been done to date about the social factors that lead to virtue and vice. It is an entirely secular volume published by Oxford University Press. And at the outset, I explained that Seligman finds the research suggests external religion increases prejudice. Do you remember I said that? That's what the data suggests. External religion. That is, people using religion as a kind of social cultural badge. But he actually explains internal religion has the opposite effect. Intrinsic faith is one of the greatest predictors of altruism, according to secular experts. Let me read this quotation. Among youth, religiousness is associated with a tendency to avoid a range of antisocial activities, including drug use, drug selling, and other illicit activities. Religiousness is associated with lower levels of marital conflict, greater perceived spousal support, more consistent parenting, and less conflictual and more supportive relationships between adolescents and their parents. Religiousness, particularly church involvement, also has been identified as a robust predictor of altruism, volunteerism, and philanthropy. This is not Christians showing off about themselves. This is a summary of all the research done to date. That people who are internally religious, especially those involved with Christian churches, are altruistic, voluntaristic, and philanthropic. Therefore, to bring this to a close, dismissing Christianity on the basis of the bad behavior of Christians is like dismissing Johann Sebastian Bach after hearing me try to perform one of his pieces. We all know Bach was a genius. But if you hear me attempt the cello suites, for example, you might question whether Bach knew what he was doing. Except you know to distinguish between the terrible performance and the original composition. And just to help you imagine this,
it's easy to dismiss the religion of Jesus Christ on account of the many sins of his followers.
But perhaps it's too easy. Like judging a piece of music on the basis of a bad performance.
This is Bach's Cello Suites, one of the most beautiful, mathematically sublime pieces ever composed. But imagine if I played it.
I've listened to the Cello Suites for years,
but I'd never picked up a cello until last week.
To judge a piece fairly, we know to distinguish between the masterpiece that was written and the pretty ordinary performance. Jesus wrote a beautiful composition. Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. There's no denying that Christians have sometimes played completely out of tune, pursuing hatred, opulence, and bloodshed in Christ's name. But they've also played it beautifully and with lasting effect.
Of course, a divine performance doesn't cancel out a hellish one. But all of this should remind us that a bad delivery doesn't diminish the genius of the original composition.
It's an open question how consistently the church has played the melody Jesus gave the world. What can't be doubted is that the message of Jesus has resonated far beyond the walls of the church. Whatever we make of Christianity's theological claims, its ethic of love has given us much of what we value most in the world today.
It's very Scandinavian polite of you to clap my performance. But then when you hear that professional cellist pick it up, you realize, oh, that's how it's meant to be played. But the point, of course, is obvious. Jesus wrote the most beautiful melody in the history of the world. Not just the call to love your enemy, but his gospel of the self-giving love of God for the enemy on the cross. Now, it is true, Christians have not performed that composition consistently. But we should be the first to be able to admit this and not hide it, because we know we are fallen. Simultaneously sinner and saint. And we need to try and ask our skeptical friends to look past our poor performance and listen to the melody of Jesus Christ, the gospel. But in terms of our apologetic to the world, we must strive to play the beautiful tune of Jesus. Because in the end, the best apologetic is not an historical argument about the history of the church. The best apologetic is a life lived in tune with the love of God in Jesus Christ. We must live the gospel we proclaim so that people can hear the beautiful tune of Jesus. Thank you.
Thank you very, very, very much. Kanske det finns någon fråga ännu, så har vi någon minut.
In one of the slides you showed a book by Peterson and Seligman who referred to Alport's research about social prejudice. he claimed that religious people are more prejudiced than others. That's certainly nothing to be afraid of. Alport's book is a very tendentious one. It's a body of research that is could be called the founding document of the Frankfurt School or cultural Marxism. It's militantly secular, and what they write is a distortion of what they have found. They describe people who value their families as prejudiced, and if you express an admiration for your father, you are classified as authoritarian, and so on. So that's how they come to the conclusion that religious people are prejudiced.
Yes, the only thing I would say in response to that, though, is that Martin Seligman is reviewing all the studies. You can pick up the particular names and criticize a particular name, but Seligman is no fool. He is a reliable guide to these things. And he cites research, not just Alport and Ross, but plenty of research that indicates this tendency toward prejudice amongst the religious. Another would be Robert Putnam from Harvard has found the same thing. But he found two things at the same time. Putnam found that religious people tend to be more prejudiced in their views of others and also tend to do more kindness to those very others toward whom they're prejudiced. So the religious are more likely to have very low views of, say, poor black communities in the US. They'll actually express prejudiced views. And they will be doing more than anyone else in society to care for the poor black communities. Yeah. So I just want to say it's mixed. And you are no doubt right that there's a lot of research that is anti-Christian and comes from a Marxist, neo-Marxist perspective. Not denying that. But if you were to read the whole chapter of Seligman, you would see there is pretty strong research that does identify religion with prejudice. Yeah. And I think our instinct shouldn't always be to defend ourselves. Yeah. I mean, you take a topic like same-sex marriage, okay? So it is true that Christians have been amongst those saying the worst demeaning things toward the gay community. You'll also find that Christians tend to be able to be friends with people from the gay community, but they hold views that are considered prejudice. And even if we hold, as I do, a traditional view of sex and marriage, that wouldn't excuse prejudiced language about the gay community. Christians have had a tendency to speak down to other communities, to be mean-spirited toward other communities. And we ought to be able to admit this and instead follow the path of love, which doesn't mean we end up agreeing with those communities. I don't accept same-sex marriage. But I ought to be able to love and be friends with same-sex couples. Yeah.
Fler frågor eller kommentarer, vad heter det? Jag pratar med engelska. Om inte så gör jag det här.